Wouldn't the White Council get upset about that? Killing with magic, I mean?
I shrugged. The Red King was about to use this spell on an 8-year-old girl. If the Council doesn't like how I stopped that from happening, they can kiss my immaterial ass.
I found myself chuckling.
Besides, I killed vampires, not mortals, with that magic. And what are they going to do anyway? Chop my head off? I'm dead already. I saw Mort trade a look with Sir Stuart in the rearview mirror.
Why are you so angry at them, Harry?
Mort asked me. I frowned at him and then at Stuart. Why do I feel like I should be lying on a couch somewhere?
A shade is formed when something significant is left incomplete, Sir Stuart said. Part of what we do is work out what's causing you to hold on to your life so hard. That means asking questions.
What, so I can go on my way or something?
Otherwise known as leaving me alone, Mort muttered. Something like that, Sir Stuart said quickly before I could fire back at Mort. We just want to help. I gave Sir Stuart the eye and then Mort.
That's what you do? Lay spirits to rest?
Mort shrugged.
If someone didn't, this town would run out of cemetery space pretty fast.
I thought about that for a moment. Then I said, So how come you haven't laid Sir Stuart to rest? Mort said nothing. His silence was a barbed, stony thing. Sir Stuart leaned forward to put a hand on Mort's shoulder, seemed to squeeze it a little, and let go. Then he said to me,
Some things can't be mended, lad. Not by all the king's horses or all the king's men.
You're trapped here, I said quietly.
Were I trapped, it would indicate that I am the original Sir Stuart. I am not. I am but his shade.
One could think of it that way nonetheless, I suppose, he said. But I prefer to consider it differently. I regard myself as someone who was truly created with a specific purpose for his existence. I have a reason to be who and what and where I am. How many flesh and blood folk can say as much?
I scowled as I watched the snowy road ahead of us.
And what's your purpose, looking out after this loser?
Hey, I'm sitting right here, Mort complained.
I help other lost spirits, Sir Stuart said. Help them find some sort of resolution. Help teach them how to stay sane, if it is their destiny to become a Mane. And if they become a Lemur, I help introduce them to oblivion.
I turned to frown at Sir Stuart.
That's kind of cut and dried.
Some things assuredly are, he replied placidly.
So you're a Mane, huh? Like the old Roman ancestral ghost?
It isn't such a simple matter, Dresden. Your own White Council is a famous bunch of namers, he said. Their history is, I have heard, rooted in old Rome.
Yeah, I said.
He nodded. And, like the Romans, they love to name and classify and outline facts to the smallest, permanently inflexible, set-in-stone detail. The truth, however, is that the world of remnant spirits is not easily catalogued or defined, he shrugged. I dwell in Chicago. I defend Mortimer's home. I am what I am. I grunted. After a few moments, I asked,
You teach new spirits?
Of course.
Then can I ask you some questions?
By all means.
Mort muttered, Here we go.
Okay, I said. I'm a ghost and all now, and I can go through just about anything, like I went through this corridor to get inside.
Yes, Sir Stuart said, a faint smile outlining his mouth.
So how come my ass doesn't go through the seat when I sit down on...
I was rudely interrupted by the tingling sensation of passing through solid matter, beginning at my butt and moving rapidly up my spine. Cold snow started slamming into my rear end, and I let out a yelp of pure surprise. Sir Stuart had evidently known what was coming. He reached over, grabbed me by the front of my leather duster, and unceremoniously dragged me back up into the car and sat me on the seat beside him, back in the passenger compartment. I clutched at the door handle and the seat in front of me for stability, only to have my hands go right through them. I pitched forward, spinning as if I were floating in water, and this time it was my face plunging toward the icy street.
Sir Stuart hauled me back again and said, in a faintly annoyed tone, Mortimer. Mort didn't say anything, but when I was once again sitting down, I didn't fall right through the bottom of the car. He smirked at me in the rearview mirror.
You don't fall through the bottom of the car because on some deep instinctual level you regard it as a given of existence here, Sir Stewart said. You are entirely convinced that illusions such as gravity and solidity are real.
There is no spoon, I said. Sir Stewart looked at me blankly. I sighed.
If I believe in an illusory reality so much, then how come I can walk through walls? I asked.
Because you are convinced, on the same level, that ghosts can do precisely that. I felt my eyebrows trying to meet as I frowned.
So, you're saying that I don't fall through the ground because I don't think I should?
Say instead that it's because you assume that you will not, he replied. Which is why, once you actively considered the notion, you did fall through the floor. I shook my head slowly.
How do I keep from doing it again?
Mortimer is preventing it for the time being.
My advice to you is not to think about too much,
Sir Stewart said, his tone serious. Just go about your business.
You can't not think about something, I said. Quick, don't think about a purple elephant. I dare you.
Sir Stewart let out a broad laugh, but stopped and clutched at his wounded flank. I could tell it hurt him, but he still wore the smile the laugh had brought on.
It usually takes them longer to recognize that fact, he said. You're right, of course, and there will be times when you feel like you have no control whatsoever over such things.
Why? I asked, feeling somewhat exasperated.
Sir Stewart wasn't rattled by my tone.
It's something every new shade goes through. It will pass.
Huh, I said. I thought about it for a minute and said, well, it beats the hell out of acne.
From the front seat, Mort let out an explosive little snicker.
Stars and stones. I hate being the new guy.
Chapter 8
Murphy inherited her house from her grandmother, and it was at least a century old. Grandma Murphy had been a notorious rose gardener. Murphy didn't have the green thumb herself. She hired a service to take care of her grandmother's legacy. The flower garden in front would have fit a house four times as large, but it was a withered, dreary little place when covered in heavy snow. Bare, thorny branches, trimmed the previous fall, stood up from the blanket of white in skeletal silence. The house itself was a compact colonial, single-story, square, solid, and neat-looking. It had been built in a day when a 10-by-10 bedroom was considered a master suite, and when beds were routinely used by several children at a time. Murphy had upgraded it with vinyl siding, new windows, and a layer of modern insulation when she moved in, and the little house looked as if it could last another 100 years, no problem. There was a sleek, expensive black town car parked on the street outside Murphy's home, its tires on the curbside resting in several inches of snow. It couldn't have looked more out of place in the middle-class neighborhood if it had been a St. Patrick's Day parade float, complete with prancing leprechauns. Sir Stewart looked at me and then out at our surroundings, frowning.
What is it, Dresden?
That car shouldn't be there, I said.
Mort glanced at me and I pointed out the black town car. He studied it for a moment before he said,
yeah, kind of odd on a block like this.
Why? Asked Sir Stewart. It is an automatic coach, is it not?
An expensive one, I said. You don't park those on the street in weather like this. The salt and plow truck comes by, and you're looking at damage to the finish and paint. Keep going by, Morty. Circle the block.
Yeah, yeah, Mort said, his tone annoyed. I'm not an idiot.
Stay with him, I told Sir Stewart. Then I took a deep breath, remembered that I was an incorporeal spirit, and put my feet down through the floorboards of the car. I dug in my heels on the snowy street as the solid matter of the vehicle passed through me in a cloud of uncomfortable tingles. I'd meant to simply remain behind, standing, when the car had passed completely through me. I hadn't thought about things like momentum and velocity and instead I went into a tumble that ended with me making a whump sound as I hit a soft snowbank beside the home next to Murphy's. It hurt, and I pushed myself out of the snowbank, my teeth chattering, my body blanketed in cold.
"No, Harry," I told myself firmly, squeezing my eyes shut. "That's an illusion. Your mind created it to match what it knows, but you didn't hit the snowbank. You can't, and you can't be covered in snow, and therefore you can't be wet and cold."
I focused on the words, putting my will behind them, in the same way I would have to attract the attention of a ghost or spirit. I opened my eyes. The snow clinging to my body and clothes was gone. I was standing dry and wrapped in my leather duster beside the snowbank.
"Okay," I said. "That's bordering on cool."
I stuck my hands in my pockets, ignored the snow and the steady, gentle northern wind, and trudged across Grandma Murphy's rose garden to Murphy's door. I raised my hand and knocked, as I'd done so often before. A couple of things happened. First, my hand stopped above the door, close enough that you could have slid one or two pieces of paper between my knuckles and the wood, but definitely not three. There was a dull, low thud of solid impact, even though I hadn't touched the door itself. Second, light flashed, and something like a current of electricity swarmed up my arm and down my spine, throwing my body into a convulsion that left me lying on the ground, stunned. I just lay there on the snow for a moment. I tried the whole "there is no spoon" thing again, but apparently there was perception of reality, and then there was hardcore, undeniable, real reality. It took me several seconds to recover and sit up again, and several more seconds to realize that I'd been hit by something specifically engineered to stop intruding spirits. Murphy's house had been warded. Its natural defensive threshold used as a foundation for further, more aggressive defenses. And while I was only a shade of my former self, I was still wizard enough to recognize my own damned wards. Or at least, wards that were virtually identical to my own. The door opened, and Murphy appeared in it. She was a woman of well below average height, but built of spring steel. Her golden hair had been cut into a short brush over her scalp, and the stark style showed off the lines of muscles and tendons in her neck, and the pugnacious, stubborn set of her jawline. She wore jeans and a plaid shirt over a blue tee, and held her cig in her right hand. Something stabbed me in the guts and twisted upon seeing her. A rush of memories flooded over me, starting with our first meeting on a missing persons case years ago, when I'd still been doing my time as an apprentice PI and Murphy had been a uniformed cop working a beat. Every argument, every bit of banter and repartee, every moment of revelation and trust that had been built up between us came hammering into me like a thousand major league fastballs. The last memory, and the sharpest, was of facing each other in the hold of my brother's boat, trembling on the edge of a line we hadn't ever allowed ourselves to cross before. "Karen," I tried to say. It came out a whisper. Murphy's brow furrowed, and she stood still in the doorway despite the cold wind and falling snow, her eyes scanning left and right. Her eyes moved over me, past me, through me, without stopping. She didn't see me. She couldn't hear me. We weren't part of the same world anymore. It was a surprisingly painful moment of realization. Before I could get my thoughts clear of it, Murphy, still frowning, closed the door. I heard her close several locks. "Easy, lad," Sir Stuart said in a gentle, quiet voice. He hunkered down to put a hand on my shoulder. "There is no need to rush regaining your feet. It hurts, I know." "Yeah," I said quietly. I swallowed and blinked away tears that couldn't really be real.
"Why?"
"As I told you, lad, memories are life here. Life and power. Seeing the people you care for most again is going to trigger memories
much more strongly than they would in a mere mortal. It can take time to grow accustomed to it. I wrapped my arms around my knees and rested my chin on my kneecap.
How long?
Generally, Sir Stuart said very softly, until those loved ones pass on themselves. I shuddered. Yeah, I said. Well, I don't have time for that.
You have nothing but time, Dresden.
But three of my people don't, I said, my voice harsh. They're going to get hurt if I don't make things right, if I don't find my killer. I closed my eyes and took several deep breaths. I wasn't actually breathing air. I didn't need to breathe. Habit. Where's Mort?
Waiting around the corner, Sir Stuart said. He'll come in once we've given him the all clear.
What, I'm the little chicken's personal secret service now? I grumbled. I pushed myself up to my feet and eyed Murphy's house. Do you see anything threatening around here?
Not at the moment, Sir Stuart said, other than the allegedly suspicious auto coach.
Well, the house is warded. I'm not sure if the defenses are purely against insubstantial intruders, or if they might also attack a living intruder. Tell him not to touch the house with anything he wants to keep.
Sir Stuart nodded and said, I'm going to circle the place. I'll return with Mortimer.
I grunted absently, reaching out a hand to feel the wards around the place again. They were powerful, but flawed somehow. My wards were all built into the same solid barrier of energy. These wards had solidity, but it was a piecemeal thing. I felt like I was looking at a 12-foot wall built from Lego blocks. If someone with enough mystic muscle hit it right, the ward would shatter at its weakest seams. Of course, that would probably punch a hole in the barrier, but not a catastrophic one. If one portion of my ward's lost integrity, the whole thing would come down, and whatever remained of the energy that had broken it would come through. If someone knocked a bit out of these wards, it would send a bunch of Legos flying, probably soaking up all of the energy by dividing it among lots of little pieces. But the rest of the barrier would stand. That might offer several advantages on the minor league end of the power scale. The modular wards would be easy to repair compared to classic integral wards, so that even if something smashed through, the wards could be closed again in a brief time. God knows, the ingredients for the spell were probably a lot cheaper, and you wouldn't need a big-time White Council wizard to put them up. But they had a downside, too. There were a lot of things that could smash through. And if you got killed after they came inside, the ease of repair wouldn't matter much to your cooling corpse. Still, it was a hell of a lot better than nothing. The basic profile was my design, just implemented differently. Who the hell would have done this to Murphy's place, and why? I turned and stepped off the porch to peer in a window, feeling vaguely voyeuristic as I did so. But I wasn't sure what else I was going to do until Mort got here to do some speaking for me.
"Are you all right?" asked a man's voice from inside the house.
I blinked, scowled in concentration, and managed to stand up on some of the wispy shrubbery under the window until I could see over the chair back that blocked my view from where I was standing. There was a man sitting on the couch of Murphy's living room. He was wearing a black suit with a crisp white shirt and a black tie with a single stripe of maroon. His skin was dark, more Mediterranean than African, but his short, neat sweep of hair was dyed peroxide blonde. His eyes were an unsettling color, somewhere between dark honey and poison ivy, and the sharp angularity of his nose made me think of a bird of prey.
"Fine," said Murphy.
She was on her feet, her gun tucked into the waist of her jeans in front. Sig made a fine, compact 9mm, but it looked big, dangerous, and clumsy on Murphy's scale. She folded her arms and stared at the man as if he'd been found at the side of the highway, gobbling up raw roadkill.
"I told you not to show up early anymore, Childs."
"A lifetime of habit," Childs said in reply. "Honestly, it isn't something to which I give any thought."
You know how things are out there, Murphy said, jerking her chin toward the front of the house.
Start thinking about it. You catch me on a nervous evening, and maybe I shoot you through the door.
Childs folded his fingers on one knee. He didn't look like a big guy. He wasn't heavy with muscle. Neither are cobras. There was plenty of room for a gun under that expensive suit jacket.
My relationship with my employer is relatively new, but I have a sense that, should such a tragedy occur, the personal repercussions to you would be quite severe.
Murphy shrugged a shoulder.
Maybe. On the other hand, maybe we start killing his people until the price of doing business with us is too high and he breaks it off.
She smiled. It was almost gleefully wintry.
I don't have a badge anymore, Childs, but I do have friends. Special, special friends.
Between them there was a low charge of tension in the room, the silent promise of violence. Murphy's fingers were dangling casually less than 2 inches from her gun. Childs's hands were still folded on his knee. He abruptly smiled and dropped back into a more relaxed pose on the sofa.
We've coexisted well enough for the past 6 months. I see no sense in letting frayed tempers put an end to that now.
Murphy's eyes narrowed to slits.
Marcone's top murderer. Childs lifted a hand. Please, troubleshooter.
Murphy continued as if he hadn't spoken.
Doesn't back down that quickly, regardless of how survival-oriented he is. That's why you're here, Early, despite my request. You want something.
So nice to know you eventually take note of the obvious, Childs replied.
Yes, my employer sent me with a question.
Murphy frowned.
He didn't want the others to hear it being asked.
Childs nodded.
He feared it might generate unintended negative consequences.
Murphy stared at him for a moment, then rolled her eyes.
Well?
Childs showed his teeth in a smile for the first time. It made me think of skulls.
He wishes to know if you trust the ragged lady.
Murphy straightened at the question, her back going rigid. She waited to take a deep breath and exhale before responding.
What do you mean? Odd things have been happening near some of the locations she haunts.
Things that no one can quite explain. Childs shrugged, leaving his hands in plain sight, resting comfortably on the sofa.
Which part of the question is too difficult for you?
Murphy's shoulder twitched, as if her hand had been thinking about grabbing the gun from her waistband. But she took another breath before she spoke.
What's he offering for the answer?
Northerly Island. And before you ask, yes, including the beach.
I blinked at that.
The island over by Burnham Park Harbor wasn't exactly prime criminal territory, being mostly parks, fields, and a beach a lot of families visited. But Gentleman John Marcone, kingpin of Chicago's rackets and the only plain vanilla mortal to become a signatory of the Unseelie Accords, simply did not surrender territory. Not for anything. Murphy's eyes widened, too, and I watched her going through the same line of thought I had. Though, to be perfectly fair, I think she got to the end of that line before I did.
If I do agree to this, she said, her tone cautious, it will have to pass our standard verification by Monday.
Childs's face was a bland mask.
Done.
Murphy nodded and looked down at the floor for a moment, evidently marshaling her thoughts. Then she said,
there isn't a simple answer.
There rarely is, Childs noted. Murphy passed a hand back over her brush cut and studied Childs. Then she said,
when she was working with Dresden, I'd have said yes, in a heartbeat, without reservation.
Childs nodded.
And now? Now, Dresden's gone.
And she came back from Chichen Itza changed, Murphy said.
Maybe post-traumatic stress. Maybe something more than that. She's different.
Childs tilted his head.
Do you distrust her?
I don't drop my guard around her, Murphy said. And that's my answer.
The bleach blonde man considered her words for a few seconds and then nodded.
I will carry it to my employer. The island will be clear of his interests by Monday.
Will you give me your word on that?
I already have.
Childs stood up, the motion a portrait of grace. If he was a mortal, he was deadly fast. Or a ballet dancer. And somehow I didn't think he had some dance skin stuffed in his suit's pockets.
I will go. Please inform me if anything of relevance comes out of the meeting.
Murphy nodded, her hand near her gun, and watched Childs walk to the front door. Childs opened it and began to leave.
You should know, Murphy said quietly, that my trust issues don't change the fact that she's one of mine. If I think for a second that the outfit has done any harm to Molly Carpenter, the arrangement is over, and we segue directly to the OK Corral, starting with you.
Childs turned smoothly on a heel, smiling, and lifted an empty hand to mime shooting Murphy with his thumb and forefinger. He completed the turn and left the house. Murphy came over to the window where I was standing and watched Childs walk to the black town car and get in. She didn't relax her vigilance until the car had pulled out into the snow and cruised slowly away. Then she bowed her head, one hand against the window, and rubbed at her face with her other hand. I stretched my arm to put my hand out to mirror hers, being careful not to touch the wards humming quietly around the house's threshold. You could have fit two or three of Murphy's hand spans into one of mine. I saw her shoulders shake once. Then she shook her head and straightened, blinked her eyes rapidly a few times, and schooled her expression into its usual cop mask of neutrality. She turned away from me, went to the room's love seat, and curled up on one side of it. She looked tiny, with her legs bunched up against her upper body, barely more than a child, if not for the care lines on her face. There was a quiet motion, and then a tiny gray mountain lion with a notched ear and a stump of a tail appeared and leapt smoothly up onto the love seat with Murphy. She reached out a hand and gathered the cat's furry body against hers, her fingers stroking. Tears blurred my eyes as I saw Mister. My cat. When the vampire couple, the Ebes, had burned my old apartment down, I knew Mister had escaped the flames, but I didn't know what had happened to him after that. I'd been killed before I could go round him up. I remembered meeting the cat as a kitten, scrambling in a trash bin, skinny and near starvation. He'd been my roommate, or possibly landlord, ever since I'd come to Chicago. He was 30 pounds of feline arrogance. He was always good about showing up when I was upset, giving me the chance to lower my blood pressure by paying attention to him. I'm sure he thought it a saintly gesture of generosity. It's a cat thing. I don't know how long I stood there staring through the window, but suddenly Sir Stuart was beside me.
Dresden, he said quietly, there are several creatures approaching from the southeast.
You are not doing your lack of being named 3PO any good whatsoever, Sir Stuart. He blinked at me several times, then shook his head and recovered.
There are half a dozen of them, as well as a number of cars.
Okay, keep Mort in his car until I can identify them, I said. But I suspect he's in no danger.
No? The shade asked.
Know you these folk, then?
Dunno, I said. Let's go see.
Chapter 9 10 minutes later, I was humming under my breath and watching the gathering in Murphy's living room. Sir Stuart stood beside me, his expression interested, curious.
Beg pardon, wizard, he said, but what is that tune you're trying to sing?
I belted out the opening trumpet fanfare of the main theme and then said in a deep and cheesy announcer's voice,
In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's 4 greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe.
Sir Stuart frowned at me.
Created from...
The cosmic legends of the universe, I repeated in the same voice.
Sir Stuart narrowed his eyes and turned slightly away from me, his shoulders tight.
That makes no sense, none at all. It did on Saturday mornings in the 70s, apparently, I said.
I nodded at the room beyond the window, and we've got something similar going on here. Though for a hall of the Justice League it looks pretty small, real estate wasn't as expensive back then, I guess.
The guests assembled inside, Sir Stuart asked. Do you know them?
Most of them, I said. Then I felt obliged to add,
or at least I knew them 6 months ago.
Things had changed. Murphy's buzz cut was just a start. I started introducing Sir Stuart to the faces I knew. Will Borden leaned against one wall, slightly behind Murphy, his muscular arms folded. He was a man of below average height and well above average build. All of it was muscle. I was used to seeing him mostly in after-work business casual clothing, whenever he wasn't transformed into a huge dark wolf, I mean. Today he was wearing sweats and a loose top, the better for getting out of in a hurry if he wanted to change. Generally a quiet, reliable, intelligent man, Will was the leader of a local band of college kids, now all grown up, who had learned to take on the shape of wolves. They'd called themselves the Alphas for so long that the name had stopped sounding silly in my own head when I thought it. I wasn't used to seeing Will playing the heavy, but he was clearly in that role. His expression was locked into something just shy of a scowl, and his dark eyes positively smoldered with pent-up aggression. He looked like a man who wanted a fight and who would gladly jump on the first opportunity to get into one. On the couch, not far from Will, the other Alpha present was curled up into a ball in the corner, her legs up to her chest. She had straight hair the color of a mouse's fur that hung to her chin in an even sheet all the way around, and she looked as if a strong breeze might knock her to the floor. She peered owlishly out through a pair of large eyeglasses and a curtain of hair, and I got the impression that she saw the whole room at the same time. I hadn't seen her in several years, but she had been one of the original Alphas and had gotten her degree and toddled off into the vanilla world. Her name was Marcy. Next to Marcy sat a plump, cheerful-looking woman with blonde, curly hair, held sloppily in place with a couple of chopsticks, who looked a couple of years shy of qualifying to be a television grandmother. She wore a floral print dress, and on her lap she held a dog the approximate size of a bratwurst, a Yorkshire Terrier. The dog was clearly on alert, his bright, dark eyes moving from person to person around the room, but focused mostly on Marcy. He was growling deep in his chest and obviously ready to defend his owner at an instant's notice.
Abby, I told Sir Stuart. Her name's Abby. The dog is Toto.
She survived a White Court vampire who was hunting down her social circle, small-time practitioners. The little dog abruptly sprang out of Abby's arms to throw itself toward Will, but the woman moved in remarkably quick reaction and caught Toto. Except it hadn't been remarkably quick. It had simply begun half a second before the little dog had jumped. Abby was a prescient. She couldn't see far into the future, only a few seconds. But that was enough talent to make me bet there weren't many broken dishes in her kitchen. Will looked at Toto as the little dog jumped and smiled. Abby shushed the Yorkie and frowned at Will before turning to the table to pick up a cup of tea in one hand, still holding the dog with the other. Next to Abby was a brawny young man in jeans, work boots, and a heavy flannel shirt. He had dark, untidy hair and intense gray eyes, and I could have opened a bottle cap with a dimple in his chin. It took me a second to recognize him, because he'd been a couple of inches shorter and maybe 40 pounds lighter the last time I'd seen him. Daniel Carpenter, the eldest of my apprentice's younger brothers. He looked as though he were seated on a hot stove rather than a comfortable couch, like he might bounce up at any second, boldly, to do something ill-conceived. A large part of Will's attention was, I thought, focused on Daniel.
"Relax," Murphy told him. "Have some cake."
Daniel shook his head in a jerky negative.
No thank you, Miss Murphy, he said. I just don't see the point in this. I should go find Molly. If I leave right now, I can be back before an hour's up. If Molly isn't here, we'll assume it's because she has a good reason for it, Murphy said, her tone calm and utterly implacable. There's no sense in running all over town on a night like this. Besides, Will drawled, we'd find her faster. Daniel scowled from beneath his dark hair for a second, but quickly looked away. It gave me the sense that he'd run afoul of Will before, and hadn't liked the outcome. The younger man kept his mouth shut. An older man sat in the chair beside the couch, and he took the opportunity to lean over the table and pour hot tea from a china teapot into the cup in front of the young carpenter. He added a lump of sugar to it and smiled at Daniel. There was nothing hostile, impatient, or demanding in his eyes, which were the color of a robin's eggs, only complete certainty that the younger man would accept the tea and settle down. Daniel eyed the man, then dropped his eyes to the square of white cellulose at his collar and the crucifix hanging beneath it. He took a deep breath, then nodded and stirred his tea. He took the cup in both hands and settled back to wait. After a sip, he appeared to forget he was holding it, but he stayed quiet. "And you, Ms. Murphy?" asked Father Forthill, holding up the teapot. "It's a cold night. I'm sure a cup would do you good." "Why not?" she said. Forthill filled another cup for Murphy, took it to her, and pulled at his sweater vest, as if trying to coax more warmth from the garment. He turned and walked over to the window, where Sir Stuart and I stood, and held out both hands. "Are you sure there isn't a draft? I could swear I feel it." I blinked and eyed Sir Stuart, who shrugged and said, "He's one of the good ones." "Good what?" "Ministers, priests, shamans, whatever." His expression seemed to be carefully neutral. "You spend your life caring for the souls of others, you get a real sense of them." Sir Stuart nodded at Father Forthill. "Ghosts like us aren't souls, as such, but we aren't much different. He feels us, even if he isn't fully aware of it." Toto escaped Abby's lap and came scrambling over the hardwood floor to put his paws up on the walls beneath the windows. He yapped ferociously several times, staring right at me. "And dogs," Sir Stuart added. "Maybe 1 in 10 of them seem to have a talent for sensing us. Probably why they're always barking." "What about cats?" I asked. Mister had fled the living room upon the arrival of other people and wasn't in sight. "Of course, cats," Sir Stuart said, his voice faintly amused. "As far as I can tell, all cats. But they aren't terribly impressed with the fact that we're dead and still present. One rarely gets a reaction from them." Father Forthill gently scooped Toto from the floor. The little dog wiggled energetically, tail flailing in the air, and kissed Forthill's hands soundly before the old priest passed them carefully back to Abby, smiling and nodding to her before refilling his own cup of tea and sitting down again. "Who are they waiting on?" Sir Stuart asked. "This Molly person?" "Maybe," I said. There was one more chair in the room. It was closest to the door and farthest from every other piece of furniture in the room. Practically every other seat in the room would have a clear line of fire to the last chair, if it came to shooting. Maybe that was a coincidence, but I don't think so. There was a quick chirping sound, and Murphy picked up a radio smaller than a deck of cards. "Murphy, go." "Reichsmobile imminent," said a quiet voice. "Furry Knockers is running a sweep." Will blew out a sudden snort of amused breath. Murphy smiled and shook her head before she spoke into the radio. "Thanks, Eyes. Pull in as soon as she's done. Hot tea for you." "Weather's just crazy, right? Only in Chicago. Eyes out." "That is just so wrong," said Daniel, as Murphy put the radio away. "That's a terrible radio handle. It could cause mixed messages in a tactical situation." Murphy arched an eyebrow and spoke in a dry tone. "I'm trying to imagine the situation in which someone mistakenly being told to be alert for the enemy ends in disaster."
If someone on the team was juggling glass vials of a deadly virus, Will supplied promptly.
Or nitroglycerin.
Murphy nodded. Make a note. Discontinue use of radio in the event of a necessary nitroviro juggling mission.
Noted,
Will drawled. Daniel stiffened. You've got a big mouth, Mr. Borden. Will never moved.
It's not my mouth, kid. It's your skin. It's too thin.
Daniel narrowed his eyes, but Fort Hill put a hand on the brawny youth's shoulder. The old man couldn't possibly restrain Daniel physically, but his touch might as well have been a steel chain attached to a battleship's anchor. His move to rise became an adjustment of himself in his seat, and he folded his arms, scowling.
Pasty face in 5, 4, 3, came from Murphy's radio.
Backs tightened. Faces became masks. Several hands vanished from sight. Someone's teacup clinked several times in rapid succession against a saucer before it settled. I could see the front door from where I stood outside the window, and a couple of seconds after the radio stopped counting aloud, it opened upon a white court vampire. She was maybe 5'2", with a dimpled smile and dark curly hair that fell to her waist. She was wearing a white blouse with a long, full white skirt and bright scarlet ballet slippers. The first thought that went through my head was, "Oh, she's tiny and adorable," followed closely by the notion that she would be fastidious when blood was everywhere. I could just see her carefully lifting the hem of her pristine skirt so that only the scarlet slippers would touch it.
"Good evening, everyone," she said, breezing through the door without an invitation, speaking with a strong British accent. "I apologize for being a few moments late, but what's a lady to do with weather like this? Tea? Lovely."
She minced over to the table and poured some hot tea into an empty cup. Her eyes fastened on Daniel as she did, and she bowed just low enough to draw the young man's eyes to her décolletage. He flushed and looked away sternly. After a second, "Tough to blame the kid. I've been a young man. Boobs are near the center of the universe until you turn 25 or so, which is also when young men's auto insurance rates go down. This is not a coincidence." The vampire smirked, a surprisingly predatory expression on her Cupid's bow lips, and glided back to the empty chair by the door, seating herself in it like Shirley Temple on a movie set, sure that she held the attention of everyone there.
"Gutsy," I said quietly.
"Why do you say that?" Sir Stuart asked. "She came in without an invitation," I said. "I thought vampires couldn't do that." "The Reds can't. That is, they couldn't without being half paralyzed. The Black Court vampires can't cross a threshold, period. The Whites can, but it cripples their abilities, makes it very difficult to draw on their hunger for strength and speed." Sir Stuart shook his head. "Ah, yes, she's a succubus." "Well, not exactly, but the differences are academic." The Shade nodded. "I'm not exposing Mortimer to that creature." "Probably not a bad idea," I agreed. "He's got access to way too much information. They'd love to get someone like Mort under their thumb." "Hello, Felicia," Murphy said, her tone cool and professional. "All right, people. Mr. Childs won't be here tonight. I'm holding his proxy." Felicia curled the fingers of both tiny hands around the teacup and sipped it. The tea had been scalding when the others had first sipped it. They'd been cautious. The vampire took a mouthful as if it had been room-temperature Kool-Aid and swallowed it down with a little shiver of apparent pleasure.
"How convenient for you. Shall we ever see the dapper gentleman again?"
"That will be up to Marcone," Murphy replied. "Abby?" Toto was staring at Felicia and standing with stiff legs on Abby's lap. If he'd been capable of a threatening growl, he'd have been doing it. Instead, there was just a steady squeaking sound coming from his general direction. Abby took a firmer grip on Toto and looked down at a notebook in her lap.
"The Paranet continues to operate at better than 75% of its original capacity.
We actually regained contact with Minnesota, Massachusetts, and Alabama this week. She cleared her throat and blinked her eyes several times. We lost contact with Oregon.
Seattle or Tacoma? Murphy asked.
Yes, Abby said quietly. No one has heard from a member in either place there for the past 3 days.
Fort Hill crossed himself and said something beneath his breath.
Amen, Father, Felicia murmured.
Someone got their roster, Daniel said, his voice harsh. Will grunted and nodded. Do we know who?
Abby said, giving Will a brief, apologetic smile. We haven't heard from anyone, so no. We'll have to send someone to investigate.
Oh, Murphy said, shaking her head.
No. If that many people have been taken, it means one of the larger powers is at work. If the Fomor have come to Oregon in strength, we'd just be throwing our scout into a snake pit.
If we move quickly enough, Abby disagreed firmly, we might be able to save some of them.
Murphy's expression turned introspective. True, but there's nothing we can do from here. She looked at Fort Hill.
I'll find out what I can through our channels, he promised.
But I fear you will find little in the way of remedy there.
Murphy nodded. We'll kick this one up to the wardens.
Daniel snorted at exactly the same time I did.
Oh, sure, the White Council, the young man said. They're the answer to this, because they care so much about the little guy and the immediate future. They'll wander in right away, a mere year or two from now.
Will gave Daniel a flat look and the muscles along his jaw twitched. Murphy lifted a hand and said, I'll call Ramirez and ask him to expedite. I'll ask Elaine Mallory to back me up.
Elaine Mallory. When Murphy said it, the name cracked something in my head, and a geyser of memories erupted from it. Elaine had been my first friend, first crush, first lover, first victim. Or so I had believed for years, at any rate. She somehow escaped the flames that consumed my old mentor, Justin DeMorn. About a million sense memories hit me all at once. It was like trying to watch a warehouse wall lined with televisions, all of them on different stations, all of them blaring at maximum volume. Sunshine on skin, smooth curve of slender waist and leanly muscled back as Elaine dove into a moonlit swimming pool. The blindingly gentle sensation of our first kiss, slow and tentative and careful as it had been. Elaine, who had been subverted into Justin's slave, who hadn't been strong enough to defend herself when Justin came to claim her mind, who I failed to protect. Joy and pain came with those memories. It was deliriously intense, as disorienting and overwhelming as any drug. Hell's bells. I hate being the new guy. I managed to push the memories off after a few moments, in time to hear the vampire speak. Felicia cleared her throat and lifted a hand. As it happens, she said, I know that we have some assets in the area. It's possible they might be able to find something.
It's also possible that they're responsible for the disappearances, Marcy said mildly.
Nonsense, child, Felicia responded with a little toss of her head. We hardly need to capture our prey and corral them where the thick numbers will make hunting simple.
She gave Marcy a sweetly dimpled smile.
We already have such pens. They're called cities.
We will be happy for any information the White Court is willing to provide, Felicia. Murphy said, her calm, professional, neutral tone expertly dulling the edges of the previous words.
What about Chicago, Abby?
We lost two this week, Abby said. Nathan Simpson and Sunbeam Monroe.
A ghoul took Simpson, Will supplied at once. We settled his account.
Murphy glanced at Will in approval.
Have I met Sunbeam?
Abby nodded.
The college student from San Jose.
Murphy winced.
Right,
Tall girl, hippie-esque parents?
That's her. She was accompanied to the L station, and someone was waiting at her destination. She never arrived.
Murphy made a growling sound that more than made up for Toto's lack.
We know anything?
Will looked at Marcy. The stringy girl shook her head.
The snow is holding too many scents in place. I couldn't find anything solid.
She looked down at her knees and added,
Sorry.
Murphy ignored that last bit.
She shouldn't have been traveling alone. We're going to have to stress the importance of partnering up.
How? Abby asked. I mean, it's in every circular. Murphy nodded.
Will?
Will drummed his fingertips on his biceps and nodded.
I'll see to it. Thank you.
Abby blinked several times and then said,
Karen, you can't possibly mean...
People are dying, Murphy said simply. A good scare can do wonders to cure stupidity.
Or we could try protecting them, said Daniel.
Fort Hill lifted a hand again, but the younger man ignored him, rising to his feet. Daniel's voice was a rich, strong baritone. All over the world, dark things are rising up against mortals connected to the supernatural, killing them or dragging them away in the dark. Creatures that haven't been seen by mankind in the past 2 millennia are reappearing, fighting mortals, fighting one another. The shadows are boiling over with death and terror, and no one is doing anything about it. The wardens went from fighting the vampire war to a new one, against an enemy without a face or an identity. The White Council doesn't have wardens enough to handle everything that's happening anyway. If a cry for help is sent up anywhere but a major city, there's no chance at all of them showing up. Meanwhile, what are we doing? Daniel's voice filled with quiet scorn. Telling people to travel around in herds, scaring them ourselves to make them do so, as if there wasn't terror enough in the world already. Murphy stared steadily at him. Then she said, her tone hard, That's enough. Daniel ignored her, planting his feet and squaring his shoulders.
You know. You know what must be done, Ms. Murphy. You're holding 2 of the greatest weapons against darkness that the world has ever known. Bring forth the swords.
A dead silence settled on the room, into which Sir Stuart asked me conversationally,
Which swords?
The swords of the cross, I said quietly, out of habit. I could have sung it operatically without anyone there noticing. The ones with the nails from the crucifixion worked into them.
Excalibur, Durandal, and Kusanagi.
Yes, yes. Sir Stuart said, his tone a little impatient. Of course I know the swords of the cross. And the little blonde woman has 2 of them. I just stared at the burly shade for a long second. I'd found what amounted to a rumor that Amorakius was, in fact, the same sword given to King Arthur, but I hadn't ever heard anything about the other 2, despite some fairly exhaustive research over the years. The Shade had dropped their identities as if they were everyday knowledge. Sir Stuart frowned at me and said,
What is it?
I just don't... Do you know how much research I... blew out an exasperated breath, scowled, and said,
I went to public school.
Back inside, Murphy didn't break the silence. She just stared at Daniel for maybe 2 minutes. Then she directed a rather pointed glance at Felicia and eyed Daniel again. The young man glanced at Felicia and closed his eyes as his cheeks got redder and his passion swiftly deflated. He muttered something under his breath and sat down again, rather quickly. The vampire sat in her chair, staring at Daniel over the rim of her teacup and smiling as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. For all I knew, it wouldn't.
I love young men, she purred.
I just love them.
Mr. Carpenter, Murphy said. I assume you have divulged secrets enough to the enemies of humanity for one evening.
Daniel said nothing.
Then perhaps you can join Eyes and Fuzz in keeping watch outside.
He rose at once, slipping into his heavy, fleece-lined blue denim coat. It was an old, well-used garment. I'd seen his father wearing it, but it was a little big on Daniel. Without a word, he left the living room for the kitchen and went out the back door. Silence was heavy when he left.
"Both swords," Felicia said, her tone light, her periwinkle eyes on Murphy. "My, my, my."
She sipped at her tea and said,
"Of course, you'll have to kill me, dear, if you can."
The diminutive vampire looked casually at each person in the room.
"I give you one chance in four."
"I can't let the White Court know about the swords," Murphy agreed. Her fingers hung near the handle of her gun. Will watched with sleepy eyes, but sometime in the past few seconds he had managed to center his weight over his feet. Marcy still crouched with her legs curled up to the rest of her, but they were under her dress now. Within a heartbeat she could have it off and clear it from impeding her shape-shifting. Felicia was in exactly the same posture as several minutes before. She looked entirely unconcerned with any possible danger. I made a mental note never to play poker with her.
"Well, darling, if you intended to dance, there would already be music, so perhaps we should talk."
She smiled and her eyes glittered, suddenly several shades lighter than before.
"Just us girls. We can go for a walk."
Murphy snorted. She drew her gun from her belt and set it on the armrest of her chair. She rested her hand over it, not quite touching the trigger.
"I'm not an idiot, Felicia. You'll stay right where you are, as will I. Everyone else, outside."
Abby had risen before Murphy finished speaking, holding Toto carefully as she left. Will frowned at Murphy.
"You sure?"
Father Forthill rose, frowning, and said, "These old legs want to go for a little walk, in any case. Good evening, Miss Murphy."
"William."
Will literally growled, and it came out sounding like no noise a human being ought to be able to make. But then he nodded to Murphy and turned toward the door. Marcy hurried to her feet and went after him. Forthill stumped off after them. I heard everyone leave the house by the back door, probably to gather on the stone-paved patio just outside.
"I like this," Felicia said into the silence, smiling. "This charming little house feels so intimate, don't you think?"
She tilted her head.
"Are the swords on the premises?"
"I think you should name your price," Murphy responded. Felicia arched an eyebrow, a sensual little smile bending one corner of her mouth into a smirk. Murphy cleared her throat.
"Forget that. It isn't happening."
The vampire turned her mouth down into a mocking little pout.
"Such a Puritan work ethic. Business and pleasure can coexist, you know."
"This isn't business, Ms. Wraith. It's blackmail."
"Tomato, tomato," Felicia said with a shrug. "The point is, Karen, that you can hardly afford to be squeamish."
"No."
"No. You're intelligent, skilled, and strong-willed, quite formidable," she smiled, "for a mortal. But in the end, you are alone, mortal, and you are no longer beneath the aegis of city law enforcement or resident members of the White Council."
Murphy moved nothing but her lips.
"Meaning?"
Felicia sighed and said in a practical, dispassionate tone,
"The swords are valuable. They could be traded for a great deal of influence. Should the White Court learn of this and decide to take the swords, they will take you. They will ask you where they are. They will force you to surrender them."
Murphy might have twitched one shoulder in a shrug. Then she got up and walked toward Felicia, gripping her gun loosely in hand.
"And what? If I give you what you want, you'll stay quiet?"
Felicia nodded, her eyelids lowering as she watched Murphy approach.
"For a few days, at any rate, by which time you will have been able to take measures to prevent them from being taken."
Murphy said, "You want to feed on me?" Felicia ran a very pink tongue over her upper lip, her eyes growing paler.
"I do, very much.
Murphy frowned and nodded. Then she whipped the pistol in a bone-breaking stroke, smashing it into the vampire's jaw. Yes, I hissed, clenching my hand